for joining the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our
and here on Father's Day.
Yes, our sponsor is Team Power. John Deere Kubota Tractor Dealer up in Shasta Lake, California. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard.
A triplet view. Yeah,
not don't have that. Triplet view. That's a
only
dead end.
Twin
yeah,
view.
Yeah, just south of Reading, about 5 miles. And you can reach them at 226-9226. Everything tractors. I mean, they can get it done for you. Give them a call, and they'll make you a great deal. Team Power. And with that, we were talking with Mr. Ipacki about some of the things that we're not asking folks when they come into the country to be citizens. We pretty much just let them in and give them a card and hope that they do a good job. And
I'm going to know what Claire thinks about this, this business of asylum. What about this whole asylum thing? How much of this do you think or know? I mean, could go with opinion or fact, whichever you'd prefer.
Yeah, because we're covered on that. We have a disclaimer.
I know. Yeah, the beginning said that we're basically crazy
we
people, and we've muscled our way in. You know, and they have no control over us during this time period. Yeah, it's a very long disclaimer. It makes us really sound like nutcases.
Yeah, we're going to say something bad.
I know.
Yeah,
kind of makes me want to actually.
Yeah,
but. That's a bad road to go down. All right, back to Claire. All right, so I'm kind of curious, how many of these other countries, since you've studied this a lot more than we have, how many of these other countries was this a big asylum push? Because that's what it looked like from here, that's how they overwhelmed all these countries in Europe was, oh, you got to let us in, you know, we need asylum. Is that what they're doing to us?
Well, it's a little bit different in terms of the geography, of course, because...
Right.
A lot of the migrants that pushed on into Western Europe over the last few years come from places a lot closer to Western Europe
Middle
East, Southwest Asia, North Africa. And a lot of that migration was instigated by upheavals, war, chaos, in those places. Interestingly, we've published recently at the Center for Security Policy, www.centerforsecuritypolicy.org or securefreedom.org, take to the same place, a paper, an occasional paper, written by the very brilliant Jeff Nyquist and a co-author from Romania. And the paper describes you can find it at our website. That's what I mean to say there. It's published there. It describes the potential intentionality of some of the really indiscriminate aerial bombardment, for example, by Russia in the Middle East battle space of identifiable, known civilian areas with the perhaps intent of spurring outflow of people, refugees fleeing the area and on up into Europe. Now, what we can say for sure, what we know is happening, is that in many cases of the Middle East there, where Sunni populations, Sunnis comprise the majority of the opposition to Bashar al-Assad's murderous regime in Damascus, Brotherhood included, Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, other militias, but in places where they've been pushed out and maybe become part of that refugee flow, literally Iran, the jihad regime of Tehran, and its proxies, its Shiite militia proxies, Hezbollah and others, are literally resettling Shiites in those places. So you're looking at not just an ethnic cleansing of areas, but also the resettlement, the repopulation of those areas by Shiites in order to create a situation on the ground that is dominated by Shiites and out of Iran. Now, all that is a little bit by the by when we're talking about the influx into Europe, but that geographical proximity was my point, that that contributes to much of what we see there. And we've even, you know, again, I'll go back to the center's publications, we've even called that flow a hijra. Hijra, of course, referring to the year 622, migration of the early Muslims with Muhammad out of Mecca to Medina. And that flow out of the Middle East and towards Western Europe might rightly be called a hijra. It's the title of a book, a slim monograph, really, that was published by the center a couple of years ago, written by Anne Corcoran. Look her up. You want to know more about the refugee situation, refugee program, resettlement program in the United States? Go to Anne Corcoran. Refugee Resettlement Watch is the name of her blog. And in any case, Hijra to America, the title of that monograph that she wrote for us at the center. So when you're talking about a migration that's comprised demographically, overwhelmingly, of young, military-age Muslim men, that really can be called a hijra for the purpose of settling areas in Western Europe that are not predominantly Muslim, but that they would like to make so. And if you look at documents like the Muslim Brotherhood's explanatory memorandum, of course, they refer very openly in that 1991 document to the settlement process, the civilizational jihad. So it's all woven up in things like that.
Claire, tell me again the occasional paper. I found the page. Tell me the man's name again,
let
please.
Let me get the exact name for you, just so that you can get that for your listeners.
Yeah, I was going to link that on there because that's useful, and you guys have a lot of information on there.
Mm-hmm.
More than I could just scan and pull out. It's like, oh, there's a whole lot of topics on here. You guys
it's called Russian Strategy and Europe's Refugee Crisis. It's an occasional paper published in late April this year at the center's website. The authors are Jeff Nyquist, and his co-author is Dr. Ancha Maria Cernea, his Romanian co-author.
Okay, perfect. I will link that.
Hey, Claire, would you say that what you just described, especially going back 622, moving into the European countries, was that just a form of invasion?
Yes.
I'm asking the question because, say again?
Quite simply, yes.
Okay. I wasn't setting you up for anything because I was intrigued because I know we've talked about what's happening today or in the present tense, and it seems like they're following a formula, if you will. Correct me for my own education, but it sounds like they're following a very similar formula. Am I close? Or?
Yeah, no, exactly so. When you look at documents like the Muslim Brotherhood's explanatory memorandum, Or others like the document they've come to call The Project, which was a document seized by Swiss authorities during a raid on the Senior Muslim Brotherhood villa owned by Yusuf Nada in Switzerland shortly after 9/11. So that was around November 2001. That document, The Project, lays out in quite a bit of extensive and explicit detail exactly how Islam intends to conquer the West. That's what they wrote in that document. The Muslim Brotherhood wrote that. And invasion is part of it. Overwhelming a society with outsiders coming in who do not hold the same principles, values, traditions, certainly don't have the same history. It's all laid out in those documents, and then we see it actually happening.
We talked about this also, Claire, coming across the borders. I remember when I first talked to you about this, oh, correct me, 8 years ago, I think it was, we captured or we were able to recover bits and pieces of documents out in the Arizona desert of Islamic of the Islamic movement, and based on those documents, we saw bits and pieces of their game plan to subdue a culture or a community, and to bring strife, but also to move in and change a culture. So it's very similar to what I'm hearing you say. Is that correct?
Well, we have their documents in our hands. Some of it's seized by law enforcement. Others published. And, well, they told us exactly what they're going to do, and now they're doing it.
Yep.
We have difficulty believing people who just tell us that they're going to come in and wreck everything. And then, of course, we spend a lot of time denying that. We're going to come right back with our guests, Claire Lopez, and for you, Lyle, on Father's Day, Dr. Lyle Rapacki. We had the lovely Walk Like a Man, but now we're going to have the alternative for you, just in case you want to be multicultural. We'll be right back.
Slight feet up the street, bend your back, shift your arm, then you pull it back. Life's hard, you know.
Oh, hey, oh.
Strike a pose on a Cadillac. If you want to find all the cops, they're hanging out in the donut shop. They sing and dance.
Oh, hey, oh.
They spin the truck, boom, down the block. All the Japanese with their yen. The party boys call the Kremlin. And the Chinese know.
Oh, hey, oh.
They walk the line like the Egyptian.
Doing. I was all motion focused today.
Yeah, you were too. Dancing like an Egyptian and running through the jungle.
Dude, Lyle walking like an Egyptian.
He's his Father's Day. Who knows what's going to happen when I get home? Hey, Lyle, we were talking about the border. One of the things that I've always been a little curious about is these folks, you know, travel hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles to cross the border and come to America. They don't have two nickels to rub together, and so they come to the United States, but somehow magically they come up with $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 to pay a coyote to cross the border. How does that work? And wouldn't that be some kind of giant red flag for the authorities if somebody paid $5,000 to get here? There's something else going on there, isn't there? I mean, either human trafficking or who knows what. To pay that kind of money, and where does that money come from?
Well, that's a multifaceted answer because, you know, of course, they may save up for several years to collect that amount of funds to pay the coyotes. They're also involved in drug trafficking themselves or in some form assisting the cartels so they can earn some extra funds. Yes, sex trafficking. There's a whole host or a litany of things on their sorted menu to collect the funds by which they can then turn around and pay the coyotes to bring them up to and through the border. So mm-hmm. Not only do they come up through Mexico, which doesn't touch them, by the way, so that's another show,
right.
And then through the border, but then they're brought into safe areas. Oh, my gosh, well, we've documented 75 miles, even 100 miles into the United States, and then they're discharged and sent their ways.
Right.
So there's a multiplicity of ways that they're raising those funds. But you're right; they're paying mostly now. It's $5,000 a head to have somebody escort them into the United States. Once they get here, though, they have a system that they're well versed in on how to collect assistance. Anywhere from medical to food to even short-term housing. A lot of the religious groups were receiving federal funding to assist, quote-unquote, all these immigrants coming into the United States. And by that I mean they were given food stamps, housing, medical, I mean, just going down the list. They were given cash. They were really set up to be taken care of for at least the first 6 months being in the United States. I've noticed that Mr. Trump went ahead and cut all that out, and wouldn't you know, within days after that happening in this last budget cycle, a lot of these religious groups have gone out of business. They're not supporting the quote-unquote refugees anymore.
Mm.
And that's in part because the religious groups were making monies themselves. This is not my opinion. One day I had two senior legislators in Arizona so fed up with a ecumenical group that they brought the ecumenical group into a private meeting in the state capitol in Arizona to question the executive director, the state chairman, and a couple of others. I think there was five people. And they asked if I would be there, and Claire knows this well because she sat across from me. I asked if she would participate, and she graciously said yes. And I got annoyed, if you remember, Claire. I got annoyed at the lies. I got annoyed at the executive director and then I think the state chairman of those religious groups lying to the legislators and senior staff. And I really nailed them. But Claire did an absolutely brilliant job asking some very tough questions that they just couldn't answer or they refused to answer, because if they did answer, it would show their complicity to being paid for every person they helped, quote unquote. They got a percentage. Do you remember that, Claire?
Yeah, I remember very well. And in fact, the questions that they were most stumped by were questions relating to vetting and security, background checks.
Yes.
They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to be involved in it. They didn't want anything to do with it. They basically shrugged it off as somebody else's responsibility, and their job was only to resettle people. They didn't care where they came from, what their background was,
correct,
what they believed, what they carried with them in hearts and minds. None of that mattered to them at all. This is Catholic Charities. We could name, as Ann Corcoran does at her website, Refugee Resettlement Watch, others involved in this racket, and believe me, it's a racket. Lots of them, faith-based groups, the Methodists, the Lutherans, the Hebrew Aid Society, and on down the list, in addition to Catholic Charities, but it is certainly a money-making racket, and they could care less about security.
Well, Anna,
one of the reasons we, if I could, Aaron, for a second, one of the reasons this was brought up at that time is because there was a piece of legislation that was being considered, and that legislation had to do with, while these people are under your care, in other words, you're sponsoring them. Claire, correct me, because I remember I asked that executive director, is it not true that you are sponsoring these refugees? And she said, well, yes, it is. And during the time you sponsor them, it's about a six-month period. She said, yes, sometimes 9 months. And I said, during that period of time, you feed them, you house them, you give them funds, you do, and she said, yes, 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 yes. During that time period, the one senator said, if they commit crime or crimes, should you, meaning Catholic Charities, Methodists, and all that, should you also be held accountable? And there were crickets in the room. Remember that, Claire?
Yeah, absolutely. They want nothing to do with any responsibility for who these people are, where they come from, or, again, what they bring with them in hearts and minds. And that's what's so key. It's not necessarily only just about where they come from in terms of which countries or which battle zones or what have you. It is what do they carry with them in hearts and minds. And they just do not want to be bothered with that. They don't care what they come here with, intending to do, not intending to do. What their beliefs are, what their ideology is, what their allegiances are, or even, you know, whether they turn out to be intending criminals. So Their responsibility financially is for 90 days. It's 3 months or
wow.
so. 90
well,
days.
Well, I'm looking at yeah.
And after that, the entire responsibility falls on the local municipality, region, state, which in our current legal system under federal law have no input and no say-so in the process of bringing in and resettling refugees. The states and the counties, the municipalities, towns, are cut out of the process. It goes directly from the United Nations Human Rights Council, which sets up the refugee camps and processes those who are intending refugees, and then deals, literally deals, are made with each nation state, in our case with the Department of State, and then the Department of State in the U.S. contracts, literally contracts, by the head with local aid agencies, VALEGs they're sometimes called, voluntary agencies. These are NGOs,
yes.
non-governmental organizations, which profit massively from the U.S. government, not just from the by-the-head cost payment, but also from various grants they're able to tap into from Department of Education, Department of Health and Human Services, and so forth. Their responsibility, though, as I said, lasts for 3 months, 90 days, after which everything for the rest of their lives of these refugees being dumped into these towns, which have no advance warning, they're not part of the process, they're not allowed to say no, their unfunded mandate is to take care of these people for the rest of their lives, health, education, housing, language assistance, job assistance, training, you name it.
Correct.
And that federal system has got to be changed.
If I remember correctly, Claire, that once they dump them into these cities, and they literally are, guys. I mean, we're cutting through this. We're not being politically correct here. They dump them. They dump them in already predetermined communities that they've chosen. They, meaning the charities that are under contract to the federal government and receive a percentage per head. But once they dump them into these communities, the communities are then responsible for taking care of it. And I thought, Claire, that some of the communities were paying the religious charities a stipend to stay on beyond the 90 days. I may be wrong on that, but I thought
I think what happens, that may be so. But in general, what happens is that those municipalities are the responsible party for the upkeep, the maintenance, the livelihood of these refugees that they never asked for, never participated in discussing with the U.S. government, and had no say-so in who comes, how many, how fast, with what, you know, rate of flow or anything else, whether they're housing situation, whether their schools, whether their clinics and hospitals would be completely overwhelmed. It doesn't matter. They don't care.
Thanks for that explanation.
That's what they do.
That really answers the question. I heard the other day they were actually referring to these folks as undocumented Americans. So that must be when they reach that title, once they get dumped into the community.
They're documented in a different way. I mean, refugees come here legally through the UNHCR, again, United Nations Human Rights Commission, that then work with the United States State Department. It's done legally. It's not that it's illegal. It's just that it's unfair. It's
right.
not fair.
No, it's totally unfair.
From, again, those Americans, those local communities on whom the responsibility is going to fall to take care of these people after 90 days.
No, you're right.
Brutal. We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, I'd like you to address, I went to Ann Corcoran's refugee resettlement. God, I just looked at it. What the heck is it? It's Refugee Resettlement Watch. Okay, I was right. Her article from today shows a picture of predominantly, working age men, 20-something age men, And here comes, she said it's another shipment from Australia. Australia rejected these asylum seekers, and now I guess they're coming here. Most are men from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Burma. And so I guess we have to have this whole boatload of men. What happened to the whole women and children
thing? Let's
talk
about that, because those are undocumented Americans right
there. Well, they're going to be our new neighbors. Ann pointed that out here. So anyway, I'll link that article. But, yeah, let's hit that when we come back. You are listening to We the People. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
A generation lost in space with no time left to start again. Jack Flash sat on a candlestick, 'cause fire is the devil's only friend. Oh, and as I watched him on the stage, my hands were clenched in fists of rage. No angel born in hell could break that Satan spell. And as
Well, let's take care of some business.
No, maybe Claire. Either one of you. What do you guys... How often do we take these boatloads of people from elsewhere because the other places look at them and go, we don't want to have a
choice? I mean, somebody had to say it's okay to get here.
Yeah, how come the Australians get to say no?
Yeah, the situation with Australia is unique. Australia, being a continent-sized island... has a little easier time, you might say, of keeping out illegal migrants than countries that are, you know, land connected to places where migrants come from. And so Australia interdicts intending migrants coming from places up further north in southeastern Asia, like Indonesia, for example, Malaysia maybe, interdicts them at sea and takes them to islands in the Western Pacific where they are held. Now, what happened under the Obama administration, the United States agreed that we would take some of these unwanted immigrants that Australia would not permit to enter its sovereign territory, that we would take them and we'd settle them here in the United States.
Wow, that's nice of us.
Typically every year, this is up to Congress, a number is reached, a limit for incoming refugees, but other categories of immigrants too. But this was a separate situation with these immigrants from Australia.
So are they vetted?
Yeah, these were their, you know, don't want them. They're not coming to Australia, but here, you can take them. And Obama said, okay, sure.
Okay, so at that point, are they going through any kind of a vetting process, or are we just, they're on the boat, so we get them?
Well, one hopes they're going through a vetting process, but what if they fail it? Where do they go?
Yeah, exactly.
So where do we send them? Back to Nauru? Nauru is one of those islands where they were held. After we pledged and promised to Australia that we were going to take them.
Right.
Anne would be the one who would be looking into that, especially. I'm sure she is.
Are we looking at... those agreements that we have, you know, with the UN and stuff like that, why are we still doing that kind of thing? I thought that was kind of Obama stuff. Shouldn't we be getting out of all
that? The United States has taken in a set number of refugees through the UNHCR for many, many, many decades. This is a standard. I mean, this is a process that we've set a number which has gone up. It's gone down over the decades for forever. It's not just under Obama. This is United States.
Didn't it go way up under him, though?
A certain number of refugees through the UN resettlement process every year.
Well, so I guess I don't have a problem with if we agree to take a certain number, that's all fine and dandy, but they still have to qualify, I would think, in some way.
Yes, they do. Yeah. They do. The problem is that the process of qualification, of validation or of vetting, background checks, is not what we here among us today would call extreme vetting. And I suspect probably President Trump would not either.
Mm. Wow.
Well, you know, it's been my experience, and Claire and I have discussed this, and we saw it in some of the cases we've worked. And she just mentioned it, where they have different categories. So let's say you're only allowing 1,000 18 to 20 year old males in. That's your category. That's your limit. Okay, so they allow 1,000 of them in. Well, then they allow 1,000 of 18 to 20 year olds from Sri Lanka only. Well, then another 1,000 from Afghanistan. Then another 1,000. I mean, they've got all these criteria that when you're all done messing with the whole thing, you're looking at 300,000, 500,000, whatever, because they've got them locked into different categories to hide what they're actually bringing in. So
right.
They can actually stand before the cameras and say, no, the limit by the UN agreement is only 1,000 18 to 20 year olds from Sri Lanka, and that's all we brought in.
Well, that's fine. I guess I don't have a problem with that. But maybe we need to have the vetting problem. Well, I do too.
But I
think the vetting process needs to be done.
There is no vetting process.
Well, that's what I mean. It needs to be done.
We found that out. There is no vetting process.
There is a vetting process. It's just not as rigorous as we would like it to be. They're not asking the questions that we talked about earlier.
Right.
Let me give you some numbers for the fiscal year 2018. First October 2017 until 30 December this year, 2018. Our refugee resettlement limit number is 45,000. In 2017, we brought in fewer than 54,000. Year before that, 2016, we brought in 85,000 refugees. So this is where the numbers have been fluctuating more or less over the last few years. The places they come from also vary from year to year. But, for example, last year, the number one place of origin was the Democratic Republic of the Congo. After that, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Burma, Ukraine, Bhutan, Iran, Eritrea, Afghanistan.
Why don't we vet them over there before they get
here? We do. The United Nations, the UNHCR, does.
Okay.
The first initial screening is done by the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission on Refugees.
Except Australia. You know, the folks that get on the boat on one of these islands, are they vetted before they get on the boat?
No, I'm talking about United Nations refugee resettlement.
Okay.
Typical way that refugees are taken into the United States. As I said, the Australia situation was different and unique. That's not typical at all.
Okay. All right.
Every year, the process ordinarily goes through the UNHCR, to the State Department, as I said, then to the voluntary agencies and on down to where they finally get settled. But the UNHCR is the first screening authority, and they're the ones that set up refugee camps, typically, you know, in and around war zones or natural disaster zones, too, places,
mm-hmm.
Typhoons, hurricanes, what have you. The UN sets up the camps, and then the UN screens the people. Number one, do they want to be resettled? Number two, can they be resettled? Number three, is there a place that will take them? The UN does all that. Then the UN contracts with each country, in our case with the Department of State, each year, and we tell the United Nations, per the U.S. Congress, they're the ones that set these limits, we'll take 45,000 this year.
Okay, but is that
after the UN screening process is done, then the United States does a screening process through the State Department.
Okay, that was my question. Is the United States doing any screening prior?
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay,
yes. It's just not up to the standards that we would like to see.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes a little more sense then. I thought maybe the UN was doing the screening and then shipping them over, and then we get what we get.
Oh, so, no.
Okay.
No, not like that.
All right.
Okay, so Lyle, you've been pretty quiet. You have 1 minute to dissent.
Well, I love Claire as my sister, but
uh-oh,
I disagree.
That's never good. That's never good.
Well, because
I don't mean to offend.
They don't.
No offense.
Claire's not going to talk to me after the show today. I know.
Nice.
But they don't know where these immigrants are coming from. They can't go back and say they went to XYZ school or were born in XYZ hospital
in Sri Lanka. No records.
They don't know. Huh?
Yeah, no records. That's always been the problem.
No, there's no records. I agree with her that the UN does screen them based on the criteria she outlined. But when you get down below all of that, they don't know who the heck these people are, where they came from, and anything else. I mean, we're seeing that just from Mexico, just south of us, that these people are coming up through the coyotes. There's no records. There's no background on that.
Right.
Well, I just think we're talking about different categories of people here.
So when refugees come in through the United Nations, Lyle's absolutely right. In a lot of cases, like these war zones, these are people that maybe fled their homes with nothing but the clothing on their backs. They don't have documents. They don't have the UN doesn't have the ability to do police checks. I mean, what are they going to do? They're going to call up the police chief of Aleppo and say, can you please check up on, you know, XYZ refugees' records? No, that's impossible. It's not done. So the UN takes between a year and 2 years to screen and to vet every candidate for refugee resettlement status. But you know, in the end, it's not a sure thing, you know, where they come from or who they are and all of that. They do go through some health screening, supposedly, and all of that. But the other categories of people that we're talking about, like those coming across the southern border, those aren't refugees. Those are economic migrants. They're illegals.
Yeah.
These are not refugees at all, and they're not coming in through that system. They're crossing the border illegally. They're criminally crossing the border without the right to do so. And so those are illegal aliens. That's a different category.
I think it's kind of weird,
even from that, you've got what we take in on an annual basis of ordinary immigrants, regular
right.
immigrants coming through a legal process of application abroad, through a U.S. consulate abroad someplace, perhaps, you know, on family basis, they've got a brother, a sister, an aunt, or whatever in the United States, and that process can take 5, 8, 10 years to get through that process. So there's different categories, but overall, we're taking in probably around 1 million people per year overall.
Wow. Well, I just think it's interesting that these people that are coming from the Middle East all happen to be fighting-age men. It's amazing. The people that are all running away from the fighting are all fighting-age men. That just seems to be kind of an odd little truism there. We have to take one
Excellent point.
Break here, and then we'll be back with the
Lopez versus Dr. Lyle Rapacki bout. And we'll, you know, at the sound of the bell, you will hear them going at it again. You're listening to We the People. Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
There you have it. And at the sound of the bell, as I promised. Okay, so Claire, I'm curious from you. Why does it seem that from the Middle East they're all fleeing, you know, conflict, but these are military age people? And how does that work?
Well, when we're talking about the flow into Europe, That's the demographic we see. Those from that area of conflict brought in through refugee resettlement channels into the United States more often comprise families, mothers, fathers, children.
Mm-hmm.
But that huge flow up into Europe of 2015 and on into 2016 and even now, that flow was the fighting age Muslim men. And, you know, that's why we call it a hijra. It was obviously an invasion of what looked like an army. And, of course, given the generous policies of some of these countries, like Germany, each one of those guys is eventually going to petition for his family to join him, which could be under the rules, the laws of Islam, 1, 2, 3, or 4 wives and all their children, who will all then be thrown onto the welfare, the very generous welfare systems of these Western European countries. You know, that's why they're having second thoughts. I mean, the whole situation, even apart from the massive wave of crime, knifings, stabbings, vehicle jihad, the rapes and all of that, is the economic cost.
It's just amazing.
Here it's different. Those coming through the refugee resettlement program, the United Nations, typically involve families.
Yeah, but here's one. A Maine man, is a guy from Maine, the state of Maine, is dead after his head was smashed in with a brick by a gang of Somali teens near Lewiston Park. My daughter has a house in Lewiston. It's a small town in Maine. And yet you have a Somali gang bashing someone's head in?
Yeah, for whatever reason, the city leadership of Lewiston, without the permission, without the input, without the okay of the citizens of Lewiston, allowed refugee resettlement groups to bring in hordes of Somalis who, among all refugees, seem to assimilate among the most poorly. This gang went running amok in a park. That's the story that you're reading there.
There should be outrage over that. I think.
But I guess people wouldn't know because apparently the Lewiston Sun Journal hinted that there's a racial component, but it says here, incredibly, never mentioned the S word, Somali.
But they're just teens.
We're just teens.
Just American
teens.
Yeah,
I mean, the people there who live there, they know. They know what's going
on.
But, you know, Lyle was talking earlier in the program about government by consent of the governed, that the job, the duty of government in the United States is conceived of by the founders anyway, is that government exists to defend the natural rights, the natural law, the natural rights of the people. That's their sole job. That is the only job of government, to uphold and defend the rights the people already have. And obviously in Lewiston, that's not quite the way it turned out.
Yeah, no kidding.
No, and it's not just Lewiston. I mean, there's a lot of communities that are being pretty much overrun, and we're just kind of taking a back seat and letting it happen. I don't understand.
Are you guys seeing our country, at the national level from a policy standpoint, not congressional action, but just, you know, State Department, that kind of thing. Are we taking a look at this? Are we reevaluating some of this, or no?
Well, there actually are members of Congress who've attempted to. I would name Brian Babin, representative from Texas. I don't think he's your representative, Lyle, but he's down there in Texas.
Right.
He introduced a bill some years ago now, basically to hit the pause button on refugee resettlement until we reform the whole process. That bill languishes to this day. People like Scott Perry, representative from the Gettysburg area of Pennsylvania, likewise introduced a similar bill, hit the pause button. Let's rework this whole refugee resettlement and immigration policy That, too, languishes. So even when they try in Congress, those who do are stymied. And, you know, this has to be action of Congress because we're talking about federal law that governs these things.
Right.
I think that's one of the reasons the Patriot Caucus has stood up against Paul Ryan, and now Paul Ryan is on the ropes because they're looking at ousting him as Speaker because of what Claire just described. He's stymieing valid legislation to bring back some order into our immigration policies. You know, just a closing thought here on something. This whole business of chain migration where these kids are coming in and they're separating them from their parents and how bad that is and woo, woo, woo. You know, a lot of these kids are not even related to the quote-unquote parents that are with them. What happens, and it's well known and documented, that parents in the home country will entrust their minor children to criminal human trafficking gangs and or surrogates to get them into the United States. And once they're here, these kids are here, and they're reparated, then they can go ahead and bring the parents in. And so the parents are trusting, hoping that their minor children somehow will get in here and get established.
Because it's easier for the kids to get established than it is if the adults come.
Because they don't want to entertain
for the kids. And it's also more emotional and more heartfelt. You know, we've got some little 12-year-old that's marched across the desert for the last 20 days or something. And while there is an emotional component, I'm not immune to that. And the fact of the matter is this is a setup. We're being played, and I think until the citizens really begin to stand up and demand, not request, demand some answers from their local city council, county supervisors, state legislators, I don't really see a whole lot changing. But I think what's happening is Mr. Trump has gone ahead and begun to give some voice to the citizens and even to a few people who are now starting to run for office. So I hope that continues.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. Well, we have a lot of potential topics we can tackle on subsequent visits. We did pretty good for no plan, actually. We did well.
Yeah, this was very good.
And we appreciate your input. Anything, any final thoughts? We got, a minute?
Yeah, I hope Claire will still talk to me after the show.
Oh, it's too late. She already messaged me. Lyle's dead.
You're dead to her, Lyle. Sorry.
She's all, WTF,
no,
what's Lyle
I
doing on
Claire
here?
I gray hair at times.
Gosh.
Well, we do appreciate both of you coming on. It's been a great show.
We're just excited that Lyle was willing to come on and just pretty much take the heat because, you know, somebody had it. It was either Lyle or Bill. And Bill's like, can we get Lyle on?
Yeah.
Because this is not good.
Yeah, come on. It's Father's Day.
Go ahead. Set Lyle up. He'll go for
solid.
It. Sure. I'm not doing anything next weekend if you need another paper mache.
Hey, I got your number, Lyle.
I'm available.
Hey, we're talking about population control next week with a Canadian, so. You know, actually, that topic and this topic, I don't know, got an odd component there of similarity in a weird way. All right, so Dr. Lyle Rapacki.
Thank you, guys.
And Claire Lopez, thank you so much for coming on with us. We totally appreciate you guys.
It's been fun.
Thank you all for having me, and Lyle for having me, too, and putting up with me.
we appreciate you guys having fun, because the topic is kind of frustrating, so if we don't goof around a little bit, people are freaking out. So thanks a lot, and happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. We will see you next week. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.